From Tralee to the Blaskets, from Lixnaw to Kilgarvan, your voice in the kingdom, Radio Kerry.
The greatest day, the story of Kerry's 36 All-Ireland football titles. Brought to you in association with Kerry Group, proud sponsors of all inter-county GAA teams.
Episode 5 of The Greatest Day details the 1914 season. In both the All-Ireland final and subsequent replay, the kingdom looked dead and buried. However, twice they managed to overturn six-point deficits. Throughout the programme, we'll be using extracts from the Kerryman newspaper, with Gary O'Sullivan bringing those words to life.
Part 1.
1914 brought Kerry their second pair of back-to-back All-Ireland titles in a decade, whilst also confirming Dick Fitzgerald as the first superstar of Gaelic football. It was also the year that the First World War began. In Ireland, police were seizing newspapers accused of campaigning against enlistment. Actor Alec Guinness was born in 1914. The Kerry squad for 1914 was along the lines of the championship-winning panel of 1913. Kerry were once more backboned by Killarney Crokes and Tralee Mitchells. Maurice McCarthy, defensive hero of the first four All-Ireland victories, was a notable absentee, having retired for a second time. Defender Paddy Foley of Lone Rangers was a newcomer to the team for the championship opener against Clare, his sole appearance of the season. Jim O'Connell of Crokes was also introduced in the backs.
The first match of the season is invariably the hardest one on our men, as it is very often difficult to get them going in proper form for the opening encounter.
Even allowing for some degree of overconfidence, the kingdom were expected to ease through against Clare.
They have already proved their worth on many hard-fought fields, and although the Clare men may give them a hard hour's play, unless through unforeseen misfortunes, our boys are to emerge victors by a comfortable margin. I, for one, would be very surprised if another All-Ireland is not coming towards Kerry this year.
Kerry defeated Clare by 3-6 to 2 goals, but neither the game nor Kerry's display garnered any great praise.
The match, on the whole, was on the rough side. During the first half, the Clare men made a most creditable display. Although our men retired victors by a comfortable majority, the score does not by any means represent the play. It can be offered as an excuse that the Kerry team had no training prior to the match.
A Munster semi-final with Tipperary was next. With events of 1913 fresh in the mind, a more dedicated effort was required. A lack of preparation could prove costly, and this would be unacceptable.
This, after all, would be a poor excuse to give if beaten. Our men have plenty of experience in this respect in the past, and if they are going to resort to the same practices during the coming season, they may get a jolt in the coming Munster matches that will leave them sadder but wiser men. The history of the Tipperary match last year ought to be a lesson that requires no repetition.
In the previous season's All-Ireland winning campaign, a late point saved Kerry from an infamous Munster Championship exit at the hands of Tip. Kerry went on to win the replay on their way to claiming the All-Ireland. Just above the Kerryman's report of the 1914 victory over Clare, there's an ad for the forthcoming Kerry vs Wexford Challenge match, a renewal of the 1913 All-Ireland final. The paper bills the July 5th encounter at the Tralee Sportsfield as a battle for football supremacy and a chance in a lifetime for the many who missed the 1913 decider. Kerry proceeded to lose the match heavily, leading to their All-Ireland prospects being written off in some quarters. The Kerryman proclaimed that a team of old-age pensioners would have done better in what was a 3-5 to 2 points loss. This Wexford win, even accounting for the fact it was but a mere challenge match, catapulted them into the tag of championship favourites for many. Kerry, meanwhile, had to regroup for the Munster semi-final against Tipperary in the second week of September. Confidence was at least partially restored when Louth fell to Kerry 2-5 to 2-1 in a further challenge match in August. Expectations in the Premier County were high ahead of their tussle with the Kingdom.
Our Tipperary friends were confident of fielding a team this year, capable of playing rings round our champions. I had it early in the year that North and South Tipperary would supply the men capable of defeating the best team ever fielded by the Kingdom.
Any apprehensions about the result against Tipperary did not filter its way through to the Kerry squad.
By the time we reached Killarney, all thought of defeat was completely wiped out of our mind. Tom Costello, Jack Lawler, Jack Rice, Con Clifford and some others were quietly playing a game of 31. Pat O'Shea was busily engaging in explaining to Johnny Mahoney and Martin Carroll the exact state of the war and the present position of the rival armies. And Maurice McCarthy and Dan Mullins were fighting old battles over again.
A Curragh man by the name of Humphrey Murphy made his Munster debut against Tipperary. The Kerry man noted how when Kerry took to the field, they looked somewhat on the heavy side, and a striking contrast to the Tipperary men who were trained to the ounce. Kerry weathered the early storm before going on to record a convincing victory.
For upwards of 15 minutes, the Kerry posts were bombarded. First blood, a point for the Tips, being scored in the early stages. The next quarter saw Kerry notching 1 point and a goal. The second moiety was principally in favour of the Kingdom's representatives and their retired victors, with 2 goals and 3 points to their credit against Tip's 2 points.
The 1970s book, Years of Glory, recalled how, after Tip opened the scoring, Johnny Skinner got the equaliser and Dennis Doyle goaled to put Kerry in front at the short whistle. Doyle then goaled in the second period and also pointed, with Dick Fitzgerald responsible for Kerry's other point.
A magnificent win, and well worthy of the best traditions of our players. The Kerry pack were not at the top of their form, and the fact that they were capable of defeating Tipperary by such a respectable score speaks well for their prospects.
Kerry hosted Cork in the Munster Decider on October 4th. The Kingdom went with an unchanged lineup from that which accounted for Tipperary. Years of Glory stated that such was the interest in the Tralee encounter, special trains ran from Valentia Harbour, Kenmare, Castle Island, Castle Gregory, Dingle, Waterford, Limerick, Cork, Youghal and Mitchelstown. For the Kerry fans who had made the trek from the four corners of the county, the journey was a worthwhile one.
Kerry continue aggressive, and Con Murphy sends along for Johnny Mahoney to open the scoring for Kerry with a minor. An invasion into Kerry ground finds Jack Lawler proving his worth, and a splendid save is effected. The Kerry forwards, who are not playing up to form, miss several likely openings. Kerry attacked in most determined fashion, and Jack Rice sent in a stinging shot, which McCarthy saved at the expense of a 50.
Amazingly, come half-time, that solitary Johnny Mahoney score was all that separated the sides. Kerry 1 point, Cork no score. In the second half, Kerry finally made their pressure tell on the scoreboard.
P. Chase shone at centre, and Doyle secured at the corner and sent to Skinner, who landed a nice point. Kerry attacked from a free, and O'Shea secured to drop a point. A free to Fitzgerald near the corner is cleared. Another free immediately let him land an easy point. Max Sweeney secured from a kick and scored a point for Cork. Healy returns, and Jack Rice secures to score another point.
That closed the scoring, and Kerry had won by 5 points to 1. Beating Cork had secured Kerry another Munster title, but they were also into the All-Ireland final. This was by virtue of the fact that some weeks previously, Kerry had won their All-Ireland semi-final. Up until 1925, if provincial championships were running behind schedule, then a county had to be nominated for the All-Ireland semi-final. 2 years earlier, Dublin had beaten Roscommon in the All-Ireland semi-final, but then lost to Louth in Leinster. Louth went on to win the All-Ireland Championship. Cork were nominated to represent Munster in the 1914 All-Ireland Hurling Semi-Final owing to the Provincial Championship not being completed. Cork defeated Galway, but then they lost to Clare in the Munster Final. Thus, Clare went on to beat Laois in the final that year, claiming their first ever All-Ireland Hurling title. In 1914, 1 week before playing Tip and a month in advance of taking on Cork, the Kingdom competed in the All-Ireland Semi-Final. They still had much work to do in order to guarantee their place in the National Decider. Jack Collins of Killarney Croaks is listed as having worn the number 8 jersey against Roscommon. Clubmate Jim O'Connell had number 14 on his back, having been at number 3 in the season opener against Clare. On September 6th, Kerry overcame Roscommon 2-4 to 1 point.
Kerry's showing was on the whole very satisfactory. They won comfortably by a 9-point margin, and if pressed, could have increased their lead considerably. During the whole hour, Roscommon made no visible impression on Kerry's representatives, and the latter practically won as they pleased.
Qualifying for the final was not enough to appease one Kerryman reader, who expressed his post-Munster final feelings in the paper.
I wish to draw attention to the very poor showing of some of the most prominent members of our team. Their display on the whole was disappointing. I understand that the Munster Council intend allocating a sum of £40 for training expenses in view of the coming All-Ireland. It is therefore up to our men to go into training at once. Jerry Collins and Billy O'Connor have signified their intention of taking the men in hand, and the fault will be with the players if they don't defeat Wexford. Yours truly, an old Gael.
For the second successive season, Wexford were to be Kerry's opponents in the All-Ireland decider. The Kingdom had prevailed in 1913, 2-2 to 3 points. Wexford had seen off Monaghan in the last four this year, 2-6 to 1 point. Kerry were trained by Gerry Collins and Billy O'Connor, while Wexford were once again in the hands of Jem Roach. Extracts from Pat Aeroplane O'Shea's unpublished memoirs have appeared in various publications down the years. In Princes of Pigskin, O'Shea notes the training regime of that era. Sprints, skipping, physical jerks, practice with the ball and trial games twice a week. Ahead of their title defence, the Kingdom seemed to be peaking at just the right time.
Unless something unforeseen occurs, the laurels should come Kerrywards. For the past 3 weeks, they have been under the hands of their trainers and their work during the present week has been highly satisfactory. Although the members of the team have been often adversely and severely criticised in these columns, still I feel certain that they understand and appreciate the motives which actuated those criticisms. They have gone through their daily routine of skipping, sprinting, etc., and while they have hardened up and improved in a marvellous manner, none of the men have been weakened owing to their exertions.
Paddy Foley, also known as PF, recounted how 26 special trains ran to Dublin from all parts. Also, a gusty wind made matters unpleasant for players and spectators. Rain had fallen incessantly during the previous 24 hours. Paddy Breen of Crokes was named in the team for the final, his first appearance of the year. William Keating dropped back to defence and Jack Rice sat out proceedings. PF's description of the early exchanges don't make for pleasant reading as two goals put Wexford in pole position.
Open, vigorous football. Reynolds and Mullally combined in a Wexford raid. Sean secured about 20 yards out and a cannon shot almost breaks the Kerry net after 16 minutes of thrilling football. Kerry bear down on their opponent's sticks. But the Kingdom sharpshooters cannot do themselves justice on the slippery going and Fitzgerald and Skinner wide in turn from good positions. Breen secures near the wing. Along the sideline he sprints and from close in crosses to Aidan Doyle. A fast grounder beats Mullins for a major. 6 points behind, the Kingdom rally gamely. Attack after attack is beaten back by stubborn defence. A well-placed free by Costello is grandly fielded by Clifford and his parting shot sails dead between the uprights for Kerry's opening point.
It proved to be Kerry's sole score of the opening half, after which Wexford led 2 goals to that one Kerry point. PF tells of the game reopening in sensational fashion.
O'Shea, the Castle Gregory Aeroplane, as Wexford called him, brought down a lofty ball, which he swung into the safe hands of Fitzgerald. Fitzgerald was tackled at once, but in the nick of time passed over to Breen. McGrath, Wexford's great goalie, never saw the ball till he retrieved it from the net. Con Murphy got the kick out, and Kerry's noted midfielder now appeared in the role of sharpshooter. From long range he let fly, and the white flag reduced the Wexford lead to a point. Time was nearly up. Kerry went off in a last do-or-die rush. The forwards missed unaccountably, but the efforts were repeated. Dick Fitz has the ball close to the Wexford sticks. He is thrown down. Pop goes the referee's whistle. Dick takes steady aim, gauges the crosswind, and gets his boot squarely under the greasy ball. He lets fly as the spectators gaze with bated breath. Like the arrow from the bow, the ball leaves his boot and crosses just above the bar.
That brought the team's level. Kerry outscored their opponents 1-2 to no score in the second period. The game ended 1-3 to 2 goals.
The greatest day. The story of Kerry's 36 All-Ireland football titles. Brought to you in association with Kerry Group. Proud sponsors of all inter-county GAA teams. Part 2.
A second meeting will be necessary to decide the All-Ireland champions of 1914. Despite that heroic second-half comeback against Wexford, not everyone was impressed, with one writer to the Kerryman calling for changes.
The forwards were unable to penetrate the Wexford backs. There was something also wrong with the centre field. New blood must be infused, as it was apparent to everyone that there were several passengers in the team. I think these crocks should stand down of their own accord to younger and better men and save the honour of the county. Yours truly, J.D. Nolan.
Plans to regroup for the replay were a shambles.
Sunday's practice at Killarney was a regular fiasco. Only 16 men out of the 36 notified turning up. Some of the men thought that their duties commenced and finished with their putting in an appearance on the field. They entered into the very little work they accomplished with the listlessness and want of spirit worthy of an old age pensioner. Their actions on the field were actually sickening.
A large crowd assembled in the hopes of witnessing a first-class match.
Their disappointment must have been bitter. And from the expressions on every face, it appears to me that they were anything but favourably impressed with the showing of some of the players present. The comments on the absent members were anything but complimentary. There must be something more than mere apathy at the back of this apparent carelessness. It was whispered a week ago that some of our players funked in a most barefaced and cowardly manner in the All-Ireland game. I was loath to believe such a rumour, but the present showing of some of the members adds weight to the statement.
No players are identified either for their absence from the practice match or their behaviour during said game. Thankfully, matters improved considerably the following week.
The team arrived in Tralee on Thursday and practices are to be held every evening at 3 o'clock. On Sunday and during the succeeding fortnight, the capital will be their headquarters and every endeavour will be made to have them ready for the 29th.
Changes were made for the replay. The Kingdom called on the services of veteran defender Maurice McCarthy, who was part of Kerry's four previous All-Ireland victories. GAA historian Father Tom Looney believes McCarthy's return was pivotal.
The replay was on the 29th of November, so we're coming very near to bad weather and so on, and this was a classic game. They convinced Maurice McCarthy of Tralee to, you know, return and play, for he had retired a few times. They begged him to come back. So he, Faith, agreed to come back. And he was on the 1903 team with the Tralee Mitchells. That was his club, of course. And his daughter afterwards married the great late Billy Myers of Killarney, four in a row man, you know. In any case, and that's his daughter, his granddaughter Catherine is in the Kerry County Board. But Maurice McCarthy's return strengthened the Kerry squad for the replay with Wexford.
Jack Rice dropped for the drawn game was reinstated. William Keating and Humphrey Murphy were the unfortunate ones to miss out. The pattern of the opening period of the replay was strangely similar to the drawn encounter.
The game is being waged steadily and strenuously, the Kerry men having to fight hard against the strong breeze. A penalty at midfield give Wexford an opening. Byrne secures and the supporters of the blue and yellow colours get a chance of using their lungs as the white flag is raised after 5 minutes. A rasper from Dick Fitz found the Wexford goalie prepared. The Kerry defenders are playing up in grand style, McCarthy, Lawler and Costello saving repeatedly. Wexford are fighting determinately and force their way to the Kerry danger zone, where Mullins' brilliance alone saves the situation with two splendid saves. Wexford cannot be held. Sean O'Kennedy raises the white flag. Mullins saved splendidly from Rossiter. Wexford were not to be denied, however. Sean O'Kennedy getting in for the third point of the game, 10 minutes from the interval. Doyle getting possession. Wexford were placed 4 points ahead. Despite the Trojan-like efforts of the Kerry men, Wexford continued to dominate the scoring department. Two further points being added per Kennedy and Byrne.
Kerry went in scoreless at the break and trailing their opponents by 6 points. The Kingdom's prospects seemed bleak at this stage. Nonetheless, the Kingdom had shown when the sides met 4 weeks previously that to write them off would be premature. Sure enough, the game was soon turned on its head.
Maurice McCarthy cleared at the Kerry end. Shea and Murphy dominated the game at midfield. The forwards are in possession. We hold our breath as the sphere travels towards McGrath. But the Kerry time has not yet come and the Wexford goalie clears. Breen is again in possession and this time he gives McGrath no chance. The green flag proclaiming that Kerry are now but 3 points behind.
They were level moments later.
Kerry field in grand style. Swing round and their huge kicking is telling on the defenders. The Wexford men are striving manfully to keep them out. But no, the Kerry men cannot be held back now. A scramble around the goal gives Johnny Mahoney a chance. His shot travels in at lightning speed and the spectators are wondering what has happened. The green flag goes up. The Kerry supporters are mad with delight. Every available article is thrown into the air. Pandemonium reigns for some minutes. The teams are level after 4.5 minutes.
By the midway point of the half, the boys in green and gold were to forge ahead.
Kerry are keeping the defenders of Wexford's end busily engaged, and to Dick Fitzgerald falls the honour of giving the Kingdom a lead. 1 point ahead and nearly half the concluding period over.
Over the last quarter, Maurice McCarthy showed just why he had been brought out of retirement while Kerry consolidated their game-winning position.
McCarthy stops a great Wexford rush and Tom Rice puts the sphere into the hands of Dick Fitzgerald. The author of How to Play Gaelic Football shows the spectators how to lift the ball over the crossbar, thus putting the Kingdom boys 2 points ahead. Wexford came along in gallant style. Murphy's kick looked dangerous when the veteran Maurice McCarthy nipped in and effected a brilliant clearance. Kerry were now dominating the game. Their footwork, fielding and kicking were superb.
Maurice McCarthy again held up a Wexford rush, and a huge punt gave Skinner an opening, which this brilliant forward was not slow to avail of, the white flag being raised.
The Kingdom were not to be denied. Cue mayhem.
The scene at the conclusion of the game baffles description. The Kerry supporters went wild with delight. Players were hoisted onto the shoulder of enthusiasts and lusty shouts reverberated through the streets of the capital, proclaiming Kerry champions of Ireland for the fifth time.
Just as in the drawn game, Kerry had kept Wexford scoreless in the second half. The victory was Kerry's by 2 goals and 3 points to 6 points.
A splendid exhibition. The general verdict was that the match was one of the finest ever witnessed. Congratulations to the Kerry 15 on their meritorious victory. Grit and stamina, coupled with science and combination, have once more proved that Kerry hold the premier position in Ireland. Our men may be approached, but they are never equalled.
PF's Kerry football story quoted Carberry in the Gaelic Athlete as commenting,
"Kerry are a wonderful lot. No one who ever saw them perform will deny. They have evolved a method of football which is ever a pleasure to watch, and have brought the game to a pitch of popularity and perfection which looked an impossibility prior to their advent. And the beauty of it all is that there were sportsmen every one. Never have foul, dishonest nor ungraceful tactics been associated with their name. On and off the field, they behave themselves in a style which does credit to their county and the game they play. The perfect system of the trial games, with regular training practised by the Kerrymen, has given the lead to Ireland. Behind all that, and perhaps the main factor in winning victory after victory, is this great morale force, a big enthusiastic county's wholehearted support. Never has a team been so loved by their county. What Goyle is not familiar with the teeming trainloads from Valley, Field and Glen who throng to the finals? With their countrymen's heart behind them,
Kerry will long keep near the top of Irish football."
The vast number of Kerry fans among the 20,000 attendants against Wexford celebrated, but not everyone could make the trip up for the replay.
In Tralee, a crowd was assembled outside the offices of this paper, and when the result was posted on the window of the Kerryman, a thunderous shout went up, and on all sides, the now familiar Up Kerry was to be heard.
Kerry, having won the All-Ireland in successive seasons, were afforded the honour of keeping the All-Ireland Championship Cup, which had been presented by the Railway Company. The Railway Company then provided a second trophy.
Kerry were welcomed home in Killarney by the brass and reel band. As the train steamed in, the victors were loudly cheered. As the train departed, the Tralee contingent was lustily cheered. A procession was then formed and marched through the town. Several houses were illuminated and bonfires blazed in various centres. In front of the town hall, Captain Dick Fitz spoke, and proceedings ended with ringing cheers.
Dick Fitz is sixth in the all-time list of championship appearances for Kerry, a list compiled by Tralee man Tim Tiger Slattery. Fitzgerald represented his county on 58 occasions in the championship. Dick Fitz's former teammate Denny Breen, speaking to the Irish press in 1963, described the Killarney man as the brainiest forward of all time, full of tricks, with a quick and alert football brain, a treat to watch. That year, the same Dick Fitz published his renowned book, How to Play Gaelic Football. Legendary GAA commentator Micheála Murathaigh believes that the book was the template for many other counties.
It was really, and I don't know what spread books had at the time, how many books would have been sold for every edition, but I'm sure lots of counties got a copy of it. And again, he paid tribute to people from other counties. I think Louth in particular mentioned people from Kildare in it. And even in 1914, he was talking about professionalism, that we should guard against it. There's a little reference to that. I think the way he puts it, "I hope the game of Gaelic football will never become the possession of professional players." He thought it would ruin it. So he was far-seeing in many ways. So Dick was a player that'll never be forgotten.
Fitzgerald covers a wide range of topics. The book's introduction sees Fitzgerald express his belief that football is a scientific game, referring to the previous year's mini All-Ireland against Louth.
Can anyone say that Gaelic football is unscientific, since the memorable encounters between Kerry and Louth in May and June 1913? Some 40,000 people witnessed each of these strenuous tussles for supremacy, and it has been said on all sides that never in the history of outdoor games in Ireland have people gone home so well pleased with what they then saw.
Fitzgerald goes on to discuss a topic which to this day is one of the most divisive among the GAA fraternity.
It is to be hoped that Gaelic football will always remain as natural a game as it is today, and accordingly we trust that, while it will ever be developing on the scientific side, it may never become the possession of the professional player. Here we touch professionalism, which, as we have observed, has so much invaded sport in our days. We have a decided objection to see Gaelic footballers approach the game from anything like a professional standpoint, and, on that account, we are slow to suggest any special system of preparation for the playing of the game generally.
Another chapter sees Fitzgerald proceed to discuss the merits of each line in the field. The standout piece from the chapter, in which he goes into detail as regards the duties of each player, is that in which Fitzgerald puts forward his thoughts on midfielders.
It is not of vital importance that they should be either expert kickers or extra fast men. Of course, speed and good kicking are very desirable qualities in them, as in the rest of the team. But it is curious that some of our own very best midfield men, like Buckley, B. O'Connor, C. Murphy and O'Shea, have not been distinguished for either quality. As they are never idle, always on the go, as it were, they should be lasting, so that no pace, no matter how hard, could wear them down. Then, too, as they get a lot of fielding to do, and generally in the teeth of strong opposition, their catching should be particularly good, and their grip of the ball ought to be vice-like. Accordingly, no matter how great the pressures of the opponent's forwards on your goal line, do not make the mistake, you in the front rank, of thinking that you will help your own defence by leaving your places and coming to the rescue of your backs. We are speaking of a game played under normal weather and ground conditions. In such circumstances, if a choice has to be made, for one reason or another, of playing a weak man as a back or a forward, it appears better policy to play the weak man on the back line rather than amongst the forwards. Why so? Well, we have already agreed that attack is the best form of defence, and therefore, by keeping a good force in attack, a side stands to gain.
The greatest day. The story of Kerry's 36 All-Ireland football titles. Brought to you in association with Kerry Group. Proud sponsors of all inter-county GAA teams. Part 3.
As one reads Fitzgerald's book, one wonders what his thoughts might be on football in the 21st century. The captaincy issue in Kerry rears its ugly head each winter. Fitzgerald's beliefs on the topic of who should skipper the side are clearly stated in Chapter 6 of his book.
The selection of the best man for the position of captain of a team is a matter of no little importance. The finest players are often sacrificed if they be placed under an incapable leader. It is not infrequently occurred that an efficient captain, by means of good generalship, has pulled many a game out of the fire. When all seem lost, such a one as we have before our mind has risen to the occasion, has suited his tactics to the circumstances, sized up the weak points in the opposition, and brought his side through with flying colours. The skipper of a team should be, as far as possible, perhaps the oldest and certainly the best all-round player. He should have a thorough knowledge of all the fine points of the game in attack and defence, and possess an unbounded spirit of keenness and enthusiasm. The latter qualities will go a long way towards inspiring the remaining members of the team. We have said that he should be one of the oldest players, because experience counts for a great deal in important contests. It is clear also that he should command the confidence and loyal support of his fellow players. On the field, he should have absolute control of his men, and be responsible for their formation and the tactics which they are to adopt. In this matter, he should have a perfectly free hand, and a selection committee, if there be such, should be slow to question his judgment.
Earlier in the decade, football became a 15-man game. Previously, it was 17-a-side. Fitzgerald felt that the game would one day become 13-a-side and venture forth his thoughts on how the game would be affected if that were to happen.
We have an idea that, later on perhaps, the number may be so reduced, or that it may be found convenient for one reason or another, at least occasionally, to establish 13-a-side matches. By looking at the diagram, which we have appended, one will see at a glance the changes that are needed. It will be observed that the central fullback of the 15-a-side game is removed from the defence, and that the centre scorer is taken away from the attack. Some might suggest, perhaps, that instead of removing these two players, it might be more appropriate to dispense with the services of the two midfield men. However, we think that the inclusion of the latter two players is necessary in Gaelic football. Their presence in the middle of the field preserves a useful element of uncertainty in the game, because the backs opposed to them can never be sure where the two turn up.
Fitzgerald also called on the GAA to resist calls for changes to football.
They complain that the game is oftentimes greatly marred by the undue frequency of fouls, and that these fouls appear to be due chiefly to the fact that the GAA rules permit the player to feel the ball, i.e. take the leather into his hands, either in the air or on the hop, while the very same rules forbid an opponent to catch the man in possession of the ball, charge him from behind, and so forth. They say that it is not in human nature to expect that a player should abstain from catching an opponent who holds the ball and looks on, as it were, at the latter getting the leather away at his ease. Further, our friendly critics would go so far as to suggest that no player should be allowed to use his hands at all, either in taking the ball in the air or on the hop, and that the ball should be played entirely on the ground. We may say at once that we are altogether in favour of any change that would be calculated to improve the game. However, we must confess that we are decidedly of the opinion that Gaelic football would not be improved were the use of the hands forbidden, and we believe that the GAA authorities would not be acting wisely in the interests of the game were they to frame a new set of rules which would lead to the playing of merely ground football as has been suggested.
What you've heard are just snippets of a book which, given its entire content, was seen as revolutionary, and the author, Dick Fitzgerald, subsequently regarded as a man before his time. A Man Before His Time was also the title of Wishy Fogarty's book about the legendary Kerry trainer of the 1920s to 1960s, Dr. Eamon O'Sullivan. Well-known author and GAA historian Owen Curry believes the similarities between Dr. Eamon and Dick Fitz are uncanny.
What he and Fitzgerald would have had in common, and it's something that the modern sports coaches all talk about, is the creation of space. What Dick Fitzgerald was talking about is moving light forwards, you know, making room, kicking the ball into ahead of the forward so that the forward gathers it facing the right direction with the right speed. Aiming rigorous, keep in your zone. You have this little square. You can't stay out of it. If you're a cornerback, you have a cornerback zone. If you're a midfielder, if you're a number eight, you stay on one side. If you're number nine, the other. So it's all about the creation of space. And it's so interesting that the development of Gaelic football as we know it has been one Kerry innovator after another.
In the wake of the All-Ireland final replay, the Kerry Evening Post was lavishing praise on the boys in green and gold and their vanquished opponents.
They are undoubtedly skillful, scientific and lead players and well deserve the honour which they have won. Probably against any other team, they would have achieved a greater success. In the Wexford men, they found opponents of splendid mettle and stamina. Everybody who has witnessed the magnificent performances of the two teams will hope that in the final round, they may again be the competitors next year.
The paper's wish came true. In 1915, Kerry reached the All-Ireland final once more. This time, though, the honours went to Wexford. The Leinster men avenged the defeats of the previous two seasons on a scoreline of 2-4 to 2-1. The 1915 victory was Wexford's first of their subsequent four in a row, a feat Kerry would equal in the 1920s and 30s. Reaching the 1918 decider meant Wexford had qualified for six All-Irelands in a row. That achievement would take Kerry a little longer to emulate.
The all-conquering Kerry team. Hooray for the brave Kerry Gaels, our champions of renown. Some of you came from Beauty's home, and some from Trilly Town. One comes from Castle by the Sea, and one from Cahir Stream, and Curragh Centre stalwart too, to build our Kerry team. From Gaelic Munster's rugged peaks, you're looked upon with pride, and also by our brother Gaels upon the other side. From out of the kingdom's storied hills, from mountain side and stream, go forth the strains of music sweet to greet our Kerry team. You've won the greatest honour now upon the Gaelic field, when gallant Wexford fighting sons before you had to yield. We hail you now as champions, and truly it doth seem that none can play our Gaelic game like the famous Kerry team. Now some are veterans tried and true since the famed days of Kildare, and yet as masters of the game none others can compare. For they are foremost in the fray, and still the shining team, and one is now the captain of our famous Kerry team.
You've been listening to The Greatest Day, a 36-part series documenting the story of Kerry's All-Ireland Senior Football Championship victories. The Greatest Day was presented by John Drummy, written by Joe O'Mahony, and researched and produced by the Radio Kerry Sports team. This programme was made with the support of the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland Sound and Vision Scheme.
The Greatest Day, the story of Kerry's 36 All-Ireland football titles. Brought to you in association with Kerry Group, proud sponsors of all inter-county GAA teams. Next week on The Greatest Day.
The Civil War hit the kingdom harder than most. Kerry was a county and football fraternity divided. Teammates were on opposite sides of the Civil War. One particular incident showed the bond of Kerry football that can't be broken. The tide turned for Kerry football in February 1924.
Kerry returned the goal kick, and at 40 yards range, Brosnan, with a great effort, raised the green flag.
Legend has it that Jack Walsh only started playing football 1 year earlier.
One of the greatest defensive games I have ever seen by a Kerry back was performed by the Kerry skipper on Sunday.
For Kerry, it was the chance for revenge, for not only the previous season's final defeat, but also Dublin's disrespectful treatment of Kerry legend Dick Fitzgerald.
Barrett and Cole lashed back the invading tide as the Kerry cliffs braved the Atlantic's wildest storms.